to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, thanks for having me. I definitely want to make this highly interactive, so I'm going to make a lot of different claims, some of them computer science claims, some of them economic claims, stepping far afield from my own area, a few law claims. So I'm hoping that you folks at the Berkman Center will keep an eye on me for those particular arguments. But I want to make a couple of arguments today about the efficiency of fairness relative to innovation. How is it that we might take what would classically have been understood as ethical questions and see if we can actually ask them from an economic perspective and see what the economic implications or the economic causes might be for whether or not fairness should emerge or whether or not fairness would have any relevance to innovation as a whole. So we're going to be trying to bridge a lot of different areas, some computer science ideas on the nature of information, some legal ideas on the nature of whether or not we should be using property rules or maybe liability rules for recombinant information. But mostly we're going to be drawing on ideas from economics about whether or not we can do efficient mechanism design and how can we set up the incentives in order that people do the right thing and maybe they will contribute information or innovation as a whole. So with that, I want to start with a basic claim that we all lose, we're held back when innovative activity that should take place doesn't take place because of some kind of avoidable market failure. I want to highlight what I believe are going to be a number of information market failures and why they cause innovation to not take place at as high a rate as we expect it to. So let me give you a couple examples that are just kind of fun. Maybe, you know, one or another might perceive these as relatively, quote, unfair outcomes. Are there any examples of this? So they're just starting for background. This is a fort. How many of you have seen the Star Wars movie? Well, the stormtrooper outfit turned out to be a really hot item subsequently, and the British prop designer was sued by George Lucas for £10 million after reproducing outfits from the molds that he himself engineered for the movie. But it wasn't expected those were going to have as much value. He was selling them for £1,800 each. Andrew Ainsworth countersued Lucasfilm for a share of the $6 billion in merchandising that arose from the movie. Right? Who should be owning these things? Because in this case, it was really nice. It was unanticipated windfall of a jointly produced asset, which is actually highly valuable. Many of you may have come across the case of Moore's spleen in the legal regimes. This one's kind of interesting because John Moore consented to treatment for hairy cell leukemia. But his doctor removed the spleen and was able to patent a cell line producing proteins at low cost from a particular variation of his genetic cells from his spleen. What's interesting is that because this was consent, Dr. Gold apparently got all rights, full patents to the cell line patented from his genes, giving nothing to John Moore at the time. He said, you know, John Moore said, I suppose I should, or the doctor said, I suppose I should tell you, given your history, I might make some money from this. He said, well, are you going to give me some? He said, well, it's not my intention, but if you want, we can talk about it. And they just moved on. But so the doctor got all of it, even though it was his spleen that led to the genetic cells, right? Another very interesting case that came up, in the news recently, based on some historical precedent, is that the test for detecting the AIDS virus was actually first developed by the United States National Cancer Institute, but based on a serum distilled by the French. So the French have been, in some sense, the first to almost isolate a serum that would have it, but then it was, and they provided it to the U.S. institution. Interestingly enough, a faster assay technique had also been provided by the British, but when the U.S. team applied for the patent, they didn't include anyone else, so they got all or nothing property rights in the test itself. And there was a great deal of animosity between the two research institutions after the fact, because the U.S. group didn't include the French group in the patent royalties, and each one sued. And there's a great quote directly out of Science that says, I'm afraid the cooperation that's existing between our two institutions and more generally between scientists will be greatly damaged. That's exactly the kind of intuition I want to capture for you today. In the absence of fairness, what happens is people are going to hoard their own information. That's exactly the right intuition. The footnote to this story is that the French now got the Nobel Prize. I suppose if the Americans had been a little more equitable up front, right, if they'd been a little more equitable up front, they perhaps might have shared in it, but the French actually got the Nobel Prize for having done it. So there's an interesting example of that. There's a last one that you might yourselves be encountering when you get jobs, when you go out on the market. Many of you, particularly if you go into industry, will be offered a contract. And that contract will probably say that if you create any intellectual property during the term of employment, at any time during the term of employment, your employer will own everything, will own absolutely everything. It's a really interesting question in this case because it then has a couple of interesting properties to it. And I want to argue from an information economic perspective, that's probably not efficient. I want to use two arguments using information asymmetry. You can imagine two different kinds of individual applying for jobs like this. First, you want to ask what kind of person is going to accept a contract where someone else owns all of their intellectual ideas? Well, probably it's going to be people who know that, well, maybe they're not the creative types. Those who are really creative might want to go work for someone else or go off on their own or work for a firm that gives them a more equitable proportion of their own created benefits. So that's an adverse selection on the way in. I now want to propose there's also adverse selection on the way out. Suppose after having accepted such a contract, you come up with a blockbuster idea, a cure for cancer or a test for AIDS. Then before you have distilled it to practice, it may well be in your interest to quit the company, then go pursue it. So you're getting adverse selection on the way in and on the way out. Whereas if you would provide a more equitable arrangement, because you might have conceived the idea in an environment where you would get complementary assets, you may both be better off, and you might be able to pursue it in that context. Again, I want to argue that the all-or-nothing property rights are probably going to skew the incentive for willingness to share. In this case, in the single act of disclosing to your employer you have the idea, you've not only lost all bargaining power, you've eviscerated any claim that you might have to that idea yourself, because you've then alerted them to its prospect, and since it was during the period of employment, they now own it. Okay? So, information as a source of failure has been discussed for a long time. A very nice article, fairly seminal article by Arrow in 1962, identified a number of different causes. One is simply risk. The uncertainty over the future means that there's information about whether or not you're going to be able to hedge risk, whether or not things are going to go well, whether or not things are going to go badly. That risk will tend to, in the case when you can't insure against it, that risk will tend to cause underinvestment. Imperfect protection. Because information is non-rivalrous, you come up with some great idea, someone else may be able to piggyback on it and exploit some of the fruits of the knowledge that you have created. So because of imperfect appropriation, others may be able, you may be under-motivated to create it to the full value. Bias. Each party can overvalue their contribution while undervaluing the contribution of others. This almost always happens in entrepreneurial ventures. So it's interesting what then happens about personal biases as you get contractions together. My favorite, though, is the inspection paradox. Having not heard your idea, buyers have no idea what that idea is worth. So you don't have a market for those ideas in the same way. But having told them the idea for purposes of valuing it, they don't need you anymore. There's this inspection problem that makes it very difficult to trade in information ex ante. Suppose someone else has an indispensable asset you need for the next level of innovation. If you share your idea, well, the person with the indispensable asset or property right can then pursue it because they don't need you anymore. They have the idea. So there's a difficult problem there in trading on ideas. The last one is the monopsony problem. Suppose that you need another particular asset. A great example might be, suppose you have a great new idea for fixing the Windows operating system, right? Vista had trouble recently. So if you have this fantastic idea, you could go to Microsoft and try to negotiate with that. But they have a property right in the one good you would need to innovate on top of it. So they're a monopoly seller or a monopsonist. In this case, it's entirely within their power to say, geez, that's a great idea. Thanks. Right? So they would be, so that monopsony problem, the problem of one buyer in which you would need to innovate on that information good or that information platform means it's very difficult, you have very little bargaining power in that case. All of these have been identified as different sources of failure. And then I want to touch on the subject of fairness as a whole. And this goes back a really long time. One of the first quotes we have is actually from Nicomachean Ethics, roughly 350 before the Common Era, so it's a long time. What's interesting is Aristotle has this wonderful quote that is still used in legal and ethical thinking today, which is, equals should be treated equally and unequals unequally in proportion to relevant similarities and differences. This is taken as axiomatic. We stop there. So we use that as a starting point for subsequent legal inference and subsequent moral inference. I want to argue we might even be able to derive this principle if we consider it carefully. Okay? Another one, it's kind of interesting. George Moore argued that moral statements can't really be reduced to natural properties. It's not like being able to observe whether the sun is up or then logically infer whether or not something is good, because you've always got to go back to something that's arguably a definition. You even call this the naturalist fallacy, that you actually can't necessarily apply the same tools as science in order to make conclusions about whether someone was moral or good. He even argued goodness can only be settled by appeal to moral intuitions, propositions that don't lend themselves to more reflection but are not susceptible to direct proof. I'm going to argue in the case of fairness, we may be able to submit it to direct proof. And then more recently, from Harvard, this wonderful set of ideas on justice as fairness, right? John Rawls' 1971 book on theory of justice poses this really wonderful idea of, imagine you're designing the ideal social contract. The way to do that is to imagine yourself behind a veil of ignorance in which you have no idea of your assets or endowments or abilities. Then what set of rules would you want to design in order that you would be happy to live in that system, right, without bias? It's a conceptual technique which is very clever at eliminating any kind of bias in what you would try to design as a just system. He's on the liberty principle. Everyone should have as much expansive liberties compatible with those same liberties for everyone else. And then the difference principle is kind of interesting. If one chooses to have differential abilities or differential offices, that should be in everyone's interest, and those should be open to everyone. So, for example, if a society thinks it's a good idea to have a president, well, everyone might be better off by having some leader that actually moves things in the right direction, but that office should be open to everyone. So it's an interesting set of ideas. But one interesting thing I want to draw from this is the issue here is social stability. Perceptions of unequal treatment, perceptions of injustice, would cause folks to secede from the social contract. That's the premise for a lot of that work. Okay? I want to also argue a couple of other phenomena, however, which is not just the kind of moral ethics of it, but which are the empirical results on what do we know about fairness. So this is one of my favorite articles recently that used instances of colonization to show what happened to the creation of wealth. It was a great article, American Economic Review, by Acemoglu and et al., where they took 400 instances of colonization from European countries and then examined what happened when they colonized other parts of the world. And they classified the governments as basically of two types. One was an extractive governance, where if there were originally natural resources, so gold or minerals or other things, or crops or waterways, you could actually go in and use those things to extract wealth and bring it back to the colonizing country. They also had more egalitarian governments in there. If they tended to live there, because the colonizers were minorities, they tended to put in more egalitarian governments. They wanted to preserve the rights of minorities. It's a very interesting set of observations in contrast to the arguments that natural endowments create wealth. Natural endowments would be mineral resources, it would be favorable glowing climates, it would be the absence of disease. The fascinating instance is that governments that were originally rich in natural endowments flipped after extractive governments and were poor subsequently. Those that started poor and had egalitarian governments imposed on them flipped and became wealthy. The wonderful example that they used to actually make everything clear, think of the natural experiment that took place with East and West Germany and North and South Korea. Right? They were roughly the same in economic development beforehand, but the governance in each case led to massive differences in wealth creation subsequent. So the form of governance really matters. Okay? Another one that's kind of interesting is traditional knowledge. There have been indigenous populations that might know of local properties. The neem tree was an example where it was understood to be an antiseptic. There was another one, blood of the dragon, which is supposed to have antidiuretic properties. Different pharmaceutical companies have gone in and actually used these insights to create new pharmaceutical compounds. But what's interesting is that traditional knowledge is not subject to property rights. Why? It's not novel. It's been around for a couple of generations. It's not held by a single inventor. It's been passed down through a couple of generations or collectively held. So the pharmaceutical companies have not traditionally been in the business of taking that knowledge and then compensating the people providing it. So what's happened? They've stopped interacting with the pharmaceutical companies. Again, it's that same principle I want to emphasize from the AIDS example. If inequitable treatment, people withhold their information. Another one is experimental economics. This has gotten a lot of interesting attention lately. You know, Vernon had gotten the Nobel Prize on some of the experimental economics and some interesting insights there. I want to draw your attention to the ultimatum game. The ultimatum game is a scenario in which a person gets to, the proposer gets to divide the dollar, and the other person in the game has only one role. They can accept the proposal of how to divide that dollar, and if they accept it, both parties get that allocation. If the person rejects, no one gets anything. So rational self-interest plus guile would, in theory, predict that you offer one penny and keep 99 cents for yourself. That's not what happens. In at least a fifth of the cases, people reject anything below, say, 25-30%. So they just reject it and get nothing. They prefer to take nothing as opposed to being ahead by a penny. And knowing this, the proposer tends to offer in a higher range than that. So it's not only the case that the rejectors don't accept it, people recognize this and therefore propose higher amounts. Not quite even, but not quite so inequitable that they know it's going to get rejected. So there's a lot of empirical evidence that people actually have some ingrained habits that might deviate from pure rational self-interest. So it has been the case that intellectual property rights are typically designed on efficiency principles, not those of ethics. Does it make sense to design them on the base principle of fairness? Would it make sense at all? Well, it's an interesting question. Do we have any economic reasons for fairness? Anyone want to venture any of the traditional explanations for what would economic reasons for fairness be?
Repeated game.
What's that?
Repeated game.
Repetition, absolutely. So repeated interaction is absolutely one of the possibilities. So that you might actually, if you treat someone fairly now, in expectation, if you're going to interact with them again in the future, you might expect them to treat you, so you actually get a Pareto improvement in total wealth over time, rather than defection in the prisoner's dilemma game. Other explanations for fairness? I should put some others who have authored on this on the spot, but we won't. Okay. One of them is repeated interaction, right? Often altruism, often explained in terms of repeated interaction. Another one, you can do it without repeated interaction if you look at same genes, consanguineous genes. So B sisters, for example, have the same genes. So if you help them out, it increases their chances of survival. Therefore, the whole gene will be better off. So that can be explained without interaction. Fairness can be explained in terms of other regarding preferences. If you make the ad hoc assumption that you incorporate into an individual's utility function that they actually do care about someone else's welfare, then it's also possible to get fairness. But that's designing the model in order to get the end result. So you have to be a little careful with that one. Another version of that is inequality aversion. So it's a reinterpretation of that same thing. So it's another version of other regarding preferences. In that sense, we are rejiggering the preference function to design it into the creature as opposed to being able to derive it. In no case does anyone argue for rational self-interest for a single event as fair. That will be one of our contributions. I'm going to demonstrate for you that it is possible to get rational self-interest on a single event and show you how it's done. Okay? The literature on fairness, in fact, and here is going to be one of the key steps. The literature on fairness has typically asked the question about allocative efficiency and not generative or innovative efficiency. That is going to be one of our key contributions, is re-asking the question in such a way that we focus on wealth creation, not wealth distribution. We can focus on that too, But if you omit the question of wealth creation, you're going to get different results. So that's going to be one of the issues. Okay? We're going to argue fairness is not simply an ethical choice, it is an economically rational choice. I want to actually try to give you a proof of that, and of course also argue from the empirics that, you know, wealth seems to be better in West Germany than East Germany, and South Korea relative to North Korea. Okay? Now, if we're going to be careful about this, we need a definition of fairness. We would define fairness as reward in proportion to contribution. That's not the only definition. There are multiple others. There's a really nice book, Hervé Moulin, Fair Division and Collective Welfare. Others are exogenous rights, one person, one vote. You know, we don't do that in stocks, for example, some of the preferred stock versus other kinds of stock. Fit, giving the soccer ball to the soccer player. Need, providing shelter after a disaster. Those are other definitions. I want to focus, however, on the most economic of the definitions, which is reward in proportion to contribution. Okay? And the other thing I want to do, I also make one additional conceptual step, which is not to focus necessarily on the fair allocation ex ante, but to design the fair process that leads to fair allocation ex post. This is after an innovation has occurred, not before. The problem with innovation is you don't know what's going to be critical to innovation until after you've been there. And you can't, and it's putting that cart before the horse. All right? So here's our insight. I'm going to combine Rawls with experimental economics. Okay? Rawls, in innovation, the future is a veil of ignorance. Neither party knows if his idea will be indispensable or irrelevant. Right? You just don't know if by the time you actually get to the destination, you provided the key piece that got you on the shortest path. It may be a piece that was essential. It may be a piece that just doesn't matter. We can't know until we've done that. We may have some beliefs over that, but you can't know for sure until it's actually been done. The second thing is to notice in the ultimatum game, all the experiments so far assume the proposer role and the acceptor role. We're going to deny that possibility. We're going to say, suppose you can choose the rule, only you don't know if you're going to be the person who gets to propose it or the person who gets to accept it. Now, guess what happens? All right? I'm going to give you a couple of equations and a couple of parameters. V is the value of a starting asset that is not created. If you invest V, you can get delta. This is going to be the change in wealth over time. Right? Epsilon is going to be to represent the range of uncertainty. So we start with this, we can create this, then there's a range of uncertainty whether or not it goes all the way up to there or all the way down there. This is just the expected value of it. This will be the probability of each outcome. Lambda will be the likelihood of your role as proposer or acceptor. Utility, we get to use, to actually say what's your utility for a particular kind of value. And S will represent the set of agents that might be on your team. Okay? Those are just the parameters. The illustration is up there. It's so, we don't even do anything with this as a proof, but it's so taken for granted in economics. Any diminishing marginal returns utility function causes underinvestment because people don't like risk. If you can insure against risk, then people will invest closer to optimum. But if you can't insure invest, then risk averters will underinvest, as demonstrated by the line, the expectations line below the utility line. Okay, that's so standard economics, we don't even do anything. We just take that as given. Okay? So, is self-interest alone sufficient to motivate fairness in a one-shot deal? The answer is yes. Okay? We've designed the sufficiency of self-interest in a Rawlsian ultimatum game. Self-interest is sufficient to motivate fairness. The greater the role uncertainty, the more equal is the division rule chosen by the risk averter. All right? The mathematics of this are really simple. Okay? This is your role uncertainty. This is the amount you get to keep, the percentage. This is the proposed allocation rule. Okay? You're maximizing utility. This is the chances that your utility with X or the chances of the other role of your utility. That's what the other one would keep. 1 minus X as a percentage. We simply then maximize what the proposed rule should be. Okay? Maximization in that provides this equation, setting it equal to 0. And we get a really straightforward result. The greater the role uncertainty, the greater the equality that you propose. Matter of fact, if you happen to use the log utility function, the amount you propose is exactly the uncertainty of your role. So if you're completely uncertain whether or not you get to be dictator, you propose totally equal divisions, right? And that's actually, so it's a really nice, simple result. We simply use the fact that innovation creates a veil of ignorance. Before the deal is concluded, everyone has an interest in saying you will get a fair allocation after the fact, because you don't know if your role is going to be critical or relevant. You say, look, we'll just do the fair thing. Everyone is going to get reward in proportion to contribution. In this case, each party is equally indispensable to the creation of the wealth. Each party gets half. Yes?
I'm a lawyer. I don't have mathematics in mind. Can you go over a little bit slowly again? Because my question is, this seems a little in the contrary of the common sense. And
It seems a little what?
Contrary. And when you say, okay, I don't know what I'm going to get, but depending on how much power I have a priori. So my question is, how much the power you have a priori can impact this or not in your negotiation about
Absolutely.
How you share or something like that? Sorry,
okay.
It was just too fast.
Oh, no, that's perfectly all right. Okay. The power in this case is represented by your role certainty. So lambda from 0 to 1 represents the likelihood that you will get to be dictator. If it's 1, then you know for sure you get to be dictator. In that case, you propose an allocation rule which gives you close to 1, and then 1 minus epsilon. In this case, what you're going to be doing, so at the moment, all we're doing is looking at the allocation rules. I'm going to get to the actual innovation in a moment. But in this case, how would you divide something that's going to be created between the two of you? And each party in this case actually is equally indispensable to the total wealth creation. If you remove either one of them, you can't get it, right? But in answer to the original question, your power is directly indexed by your role certainty. Do you know whether or not the likelihood that you're going to be the proposer or dictator, in which case it shows exactly that you will take more of it. You'll propose less and less and less for the other person, so it's completely consistent with what you might expect as an intuition. If you know you're going to be dictator, you say, I'm going to keep close to 100%. The greatest uncertainty is 1/2, when you don't know which one you're going to be, right? The greatest uncertainty is you don't know if you're going to be, you have equal chances of either one, right? And so in that case, you wind up proposing a division rule, which is 50-50. Okay, Oliver.
But is this really the ultimatum game, or is it a dictator game? As you've modeled it here, it's a dictator because you don't have the opportunity for turning the other down. You haven't modeled in the social response of the other side.
Yeah, that's true. So that actually is the dictator game. So you're right. In the dictator game, you could propose, and no matter what, that's the division rule. In the ultimatum game, you'd actually want to include the probability that you're not going to get anything accepted back.
The social dilemma of what happens to it becomes
correct,
now a game theory problem, not just a probability
correct.
Problem.
Exactly correct.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly correct. Okay. Now, the next thing I want to do is to actually get more towards some of the innovation questions and say, why is motivating innovation via contributed intangible resources harder than the mechanism design problem for tangible goods? I really want to emphasize this is as we're moving more and more into a remix and innovation information economy, these questions are increasingly coming to the fore. And I want to show you mathematically and intuitively why that happens. All right? So for a tangible good, this is the easy case. We'll start with the base one. For a tangible good, if the initial value is V and you can contribute V, investing is socially efficient and privately rational anytime the change exceeds the investment value. Why? Well, you're consuming the tangible good in the creation of the good. So you want to create wealth only when it exceeds what it's going to cost. Further, because it's property, you have bargaining power. In the act of disclosing it, you're not giving it away. It's not like the idea in the employment case, right? So in this case, the owner can claim at least the value that they're putting in via their property rights in V. Otherwise, they just threaten to withhold it. It's theirs. No one else can use it without their permission. You can enjoin others' use. Okay, let's take a look at information. It is socially efficient, but not necessarily privately rational to invest V whenever delta is greater than zero. Why? It's non-rival. You still have the information afterwards. You have not consumed it. But now we have a subtle problem. That is, the recipient becomes a new source of V, possibly a competitor on claims provided by V. Disclosure does compromise your bargaining power. So although it would be socially efficient to have it shared to create delta, there's a very interesting question as to who gets delta and whether or not you might then erode your own value in V by virtue of competition or other sources for V. So it's not necessarily incentive compatible. To do that, so there are two issues here. One is the difference in choice point. Is the value greater than what you're investing? And here, you actually have a lower point when you'd want the information to be transferred, but we have a harder time actually getting it released. All right? What I want to do is I want to give you a better intuition for this. Let's take an old story. It's an old proverb. Give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Teach a man a fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. Seems like a great and noble sentiment. But examine that very carefully. Consider the case, what if information itself provides a claim on a rival resource? That is, you're now claiming a certain number of fish from the lake. What happens if you get something like that? Right? You can get overfishing. You can get other people claiming the other fish in your lake. Right? It may well be the case that privately, a fisherman could feed his family and even his neighbor better by sharing his fish with neighbors than sharing his private knowledge with the entire world. The information is a claim. If the information is a claim on a rival resource, you might actually be better off personally by occasionally sharing a fish and not teaching others how to do it. This is the case even if you did it voluntarily. You could still get that via leakage and just observation. So there may be direct incentives to hoard it in any of those cases. What I want to emphasize is that in any cases where, despite the option of creating new wealth, possibly for yourself but more likely for others, loss of bargaining power, competitive supply of that information, competitive competition for claims provided by that information, each provide reason to hoard it. Each provide reason to hoard it. Mechanism design for information goods is harder than mechanism design for tangible goods. Okay, so why does the risk of deal failure worsen for groups relative to individuals? Now, what I'm going to do is give you a very simple model going back to the innovation question. What happens is you try to add new value in this case, all right? This is going to be a simple model of failure due to joint uncertainty. So here, what I've got is a demonstration here of this is the value that each individual would contribute. This delta would be the jointly created value. But then there's also some outside option that I has, delta I, so that they can create some value just with their own resource. Now, obviously, the information goods could be contributed to both of these, so that would be socially optimal. But the question then is, can they come up with some negotiation which is going to compensate I for the value of their contributed resource? This is a really simple model. To make things really, really try to get them to go through as much as possible, we allow complete certainty over what each is contributing and even complete certainty over what they might jointly create. But what might I do? If there's uncertainty over that, then there's the question of what should J allocate from the total pool to I? As long as there's uncertainty over that, there's room for some disagreement. Where one thinks the value that they're going to create is going to be greater than the other, and the other doesn't believe it, and so ex ante, they're not willing to commit to such a high payment because the beliefs don't necessarily converge, right? Yes?
Where is the uncertainty incident?
Uncertainty is the range of values provided by this delta, which is positive value there, negative value there, and this is the area where the individual I thinks there is going to be worth more than J thinks it's going to be, okay? If you could only agree to disagree until the final is revealed, contribute it, and then guarantee that you're getting a fair allocation ex post, well, wherever it shows up, well, that's what you'd get. So you could reclaim, you could recover that. Now, this problem gets worse in any case where there's uncertainty over the jointly contributed piece, or J also has an outside option that need to be compensated, or you start adding other individuals. As you add others, you add increasing uncertainty and increase the chances of deal failure. Right? If you could agree to disagree until you've actually done the innovation, then you could actually reveal what each piece is worth and then actually have achieved it. But that red region represents the probability of deal failure, just based on non-overlapping beliefs. Okay? Now, I want to ask another question. So we're giving people what I've defined as reward in proportion to contribution. It's basically the expected value of their contribution. Could another mechanism do better? Could deviations from that mechanism do better, is the question that we're asking. Okay. I'm going to argue this is the maximal sharing principle. Under a fair reward system, the joint sharing of information via project participation is at least as great as that under any other allocation. Alternate designs won't cause more information sharing, won't cause greater participation. All right, let me show you how. All right, we're going to say an alternate maximum deviates from the fair allocation by some amount, h. So notice, this was the coalition with x in it, and you're going to add, is the union, add the assets from I to it. So this is the value created by adding I to this coalition. This is the value that the coalition created without I, so this is the marginal contribution. If the bias payoff is then less than zero, then agent I strictly prefers not to bother with this project at all. Why? Because they're worse off than when they started. So that's a negative payoff if bias is there. So clearly that one's not going to work. But this is the subtler one. Suppose this part is exactly the same. Suppose this bias is now less than the payoff from their next best opportunity. Instead, they join team Y instead of team X. Well, then obviously you'd prefer to go do this one rather than this one. So that bias in the system causes them to choose different projects. Yes?
So that for any biased mechanism, there exists something where it does worse than?
That's correct. It's not forced to do worse, but there exists one where you would do worse. That's correct. Now, we can take that one step further. Suppose that H, instead of being a loss, is a benefit. Well, so now, of course, they would want, so I would be really happy because they're getting subsidized. They're getting extra payment. But what happens? Now, you don't have the marginal contribution available to give other agents, so they defect. So whether or not your bias is positive or negative, you get defection in either side. You can either get people to join your project with a positive bias, but now you can't pay others enough. Or if you have bias against that person, then there's a chance you lose them to their other outside opportunities. Okay? So the implications of this are that competing allocation mechanisms can't do better in terms of motivating participation resource contribution. Now, I want to be honest about this. Be very careful. We do not claim that total welfare gains will always be higher. You also have to account for adjudication costs, right? Entrepreneurs almost always think that their piece was the essential piece, and then you have to go to adjudicate that. So adjudication costs could actually swamp the wealth. But in terms of whether or not you would get the contribution in first place, we think you can't do better than that. There's also an interesting mechanism where you can see why unjust governance would cause lower wealth creation. People are not choosing the best project opportunities. In fact, they're choosing something else. So you will get lower wealth creation because you're not people are not doing what would not be best. And actually, the last thing I want to do here is to say equal treatment of equals is self-interestedly rational, and we don't need to take it as axiomatic. We've actually shown it's now rational ex ante to offer a fair reward in order that people join the right project. If you bias against them, they may go someplace else. If you bias for them, you may lose the other parties. So it's rational ex ante to be fair and treat equals equally. We do not need to take that as axiomatic.
Now, this does not depend upon the veil of ignorance for its derivation.
No.
Because the first one does. This one does not depend
this
upon the
not.
Veil of ignorance.
This does not.
But it does require there to be a pool of alternatives for this.
That's correct.
And the alternatives, the alternatives serve as a limit. So if fair does not necessarily have to be fully good, it only has to be as good as it meets the alternative.
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
Now, something I don't have a slide on it here, but it's actually something we're still adding to the paper. Okay, the next thing we're adding to the paper is the apartheid regime. Suppose you are a total dictator and you can bias every single one of someone else's projects. So you can extract H from project A, project B, project C. Then you do not change the assortative ordering. And under an apartheid-style regime, you don't change those. But boy, are you're destroying the outside options is what you're doing. So it's not only that you can control the resources for your own project, that gives you the power to control the resources and the bias on alternate projects, right? So that's a really bad regime in terms of what the individual might perceive, but for the dictator, they would actually be very happy with that.
But there may be, from an outcome standpoint, you may get less contribution.
They may lower effort.
Lower effort.
Yes, lower effort. Yeah. We're not capturing the effort.
No, no, okay.
All we're capturing is the assortative ordering.
Comes down. Okay.
All we're capturing is the assortative ordering. Okay?
Yeah.
Let me take this one step further. Okay? One step further. Can we align individual interests with those of society as a whole? All right? So let's see if we can take the fair reward mechanism. And this is, I think, one of our stronger results in terms of its interesting impact, the social sorting principle. Under a fair reward mechanism, agents receiving their expected marginal contribution prefer the same order over projects as a social planner. Let me show you why. All right? This is not a proof by construction, but this is an inductive proof. All right? For a set of projects open to a single agent, if there's only one agent and only one set of projects, well, by definition, the individual and the social planner have to coincide, right? So that's the baseline. So we start in individuals matching the assortative ordering of the social planner, all right? But now what I want to do is I want to go to the induction step, okay? Now consider N plus one agents and any coalitions, SX and SY, offering different projects, okay? Now, if the marginal value and total value of S project SX for this team exceeds that of SY, there's no question. Agents and social planner choose the same thing, right? If marginal and total values were said, well, the social planner would have choose that, and they'd voluntarily go to that particular project. So we have to worry about the case where it diverges, right? So now what we're going to do is we're going to examine the case where marginal value of this project exceeds the marginal value of that, but giving this the assets of this particular agent to the other project exceeds the total for this. So we write that simply as marginal value, this is the value of adding I to the team X and the marginal contribution. This is greater than the marginal value of team Y, adding Y to team Y minus the contribution without that. So the marginal value is higher, but total value of adding I to this is greater than the total value of I to that, right? So the total value of this project is greater. Now watch. I simply subtract, based on total welfare, actually, the total welfare only assigns I to team SX when total value of this project, adding them here, plus the team where they didn't get them, or the X team where didn't get them, is adding I to the competing team. So that would only happen if this total value exceeds that total value. Now, I'm going to subtract VX, VY from both sides. So if I subtract this from both sides and I subtract this from both sides, guess what? I get the exact same equation as for the agent. So they're still aligned. Since these are arbitrary, the induction step keeps them going. What this means is that the individual chooses optimally in a completely decentralized fashion if you treat them fairly. A society is choosing the most innovative projects as opposed to dominated projects if you treat them fairly, right? You don't need a social planner. Because they're going to choose the projects that are actually socially optimal for total wealth creation in the society. Okay? It's a really nice result that you'll get the best, you'll get the investment in the best opportunities as opposed to secondary opportunities under a fair reward mechanism. Okay? All right. Then let's go back and ask the original question. Because everyone has, you know, a lot of the literature on this is they bend over backwards to say, why do you want a just society? Why do you want a fair society in an allocative sense, right? Would society have, after innovation has occurred, why do you care about allocative efficiency? Innovation has happened already. Total welfare is the same. If you're adding X and Y, you're adding X and Y. You get the same number no matter which order you add them in. Why does society care? Well, let me show you. You add the innovation step, all right? Social interest and allocative efficiency, The opportunity cost to society of permitting unfair allocations is not less than that of the unscrupulous investor and can be arbitrarily greater, right? It's not the actual cost, it's the opportunity cost you care about here. When does an individual choose to forego screwing their partners? Okay? They choose that, and this is affect the value of reputation, all right? So if this is your first project, partners one and two, this is the innovation value here. If this is the innovation value over all your other project opportunities, the other agents in the society, agents 3 through N, this is the index of value you could create with them, the chances of agreement, that was just back from the original, and then this is the discount factor. So you're not going to do it this period, but next period, but next period. So this is the discount factor. And then you get, in argument, half the surplus you would create. So that's the condition for not screwing your friends on this deal in order that you can still get other deals. Right? That's your eBay reputation. But what is it to society? When you add the value, not just across partners, across both halves, but across all partnership pairs, you're not just asking whether or not you're valued in that, but you're summing it across this agent and the other agents. So the interest, the total opportunity loss cannot be less, in effect, because the first individuals is already embedded within. It has to be at least that much. Right? This is the value that would cause you'd not the individual would choose not to screw their partners based on this value. This is the social opportunity loss if, because this party screwed others, other deals didn't go through because they thought they too could get screwed. The others would choose not to go it if they believe this is an unjust society. If I contribute my stuff, I could be at the same risk as the guy that got screwed last time. Opportunity losses to others can't be less than opportunity losses to the individual. All right? So social interest in allocative efficiency has to be at least the individual's private interest in preserving their own reputation. Okay? So this is just kind of fun. Reputations do provide reasons for forbearance based on personal opportunity losses. This is the first equation. They do not account for the full social impact on innovation if others can see themselves in the patient position of being disadvantaged. Right? So society has a very strong interest in allocative efficiency ex post and doing the right thing afterwards because of the opportunity losses. Right? This is just kind of fun for the up there. The good news for the devil here is, well, you put the search term cute and cuddly, you now dominate terms for almighty evil, terrible, unforgiving, pain, suffering. You know, what's the reputation that might come out of that? So it's a reputation question versus an opportunity loss question.
Is there an incentive then to invest in false signal?
There actually is. So there actually is.
So you get.
There is an incentive. There would be an incentive to invest in false signaling. Okay. Now, one of the critiques that we often get is you've got a pretty strict result of fairness, definition of fairness. The reward in proportion to contribution. In effect, it's the Shapley value. For any of those that use it, it's the expectation. It's the expected value of your marginal contribution is what it is. Okay. Now, does this have to be perfectly fair? Because adjudicating that can be very difficult. There may be lots of information asymmetry after the fact over who contributed what, how hard folks work, things like that. So the good answer is actually no. You really don't. You need what we call, provide as a definition of sufficient fairness. Right? Sufficient fairness has two properties. Ex ante, the prospect of fairness must be sufficiently great that the individuals voluntarily choose to contribute their resources, right? So the prospect, this is the procedural fairness. The expectation of fairness needs to be sufficiently great that you're willing to move ahead. Agree to disagree so that you can find out what happens. Ex post, it must be the case that the actual fairness is such that analogous third parties would also have chosen to contribute. This solves the opportunity loss problem for society, right?
Knowing this, but knowledge of the deal as it actually played,
yes,
with analogous people.
Yes. So this is correct.
This is the individual rationality test.
That's exactly correct. Okay. Right. So what we're trying to do specifically is we're trying to get away from the disgruntled inventor who overvalues their own contribution. There is no solution for that because if you have eight people each thinking they have 120% of the final, there's no way you can divide 100%. Right. It's not going to happen. So what we have is a rationality test. Which is, would someone prefer to do this originally, and then after the fact, would others, knowing that deal, also choose to do the same thing? If that's the case, we get all the benefits. It doesn't have to be exactly fair. It just has to be sufficiently fair, right? It also further operationalizes Rawls' original insight. Would others contribute? Behind the veil of ignorance, would you have done the same thing? Now that you've got the information, would you also choose to contribute? Therefore, you get the second rounds of innovation, and others don't withhold their resources in analogous situations. It also allows the exact or specific choice of mechanism to be culturally specific. If it differs in the Amazon than it does in East Asia or, you know, New York, as long as you meet the two properties of sufficient fairness, you get the benefits.
How would it be culturally skewed? Because we really, you're talking about, in a sense, a norm here. I mean, and so would it be skewed towards a particular kind of role on a cultural basis?
That could exactly be it. You know, so there could be
a tribal role. There could be a respectfulness role.
Okay. You know, so payment certain kinds of goods as opposed to other kinds of goods.
So those would be different kinds of norms that you would have.
Absolutely. So as long as you have these properties of sufficient fairness, you get these other benefits.
That could play into some of the things in the ultimatum game where you find if people have earned or perceive that they earned a position of being the decider, that they choose greater skew.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
If you give them a test in advance and people who get to decide scored high on the test for whatever reason, then the skew increases.
Is there any empirical evidence, and just to pick up on that point, that you do have sort of roles that parties play within creating an innovation, that there are certain kind of allocative preferences that go to different kinds of roles, whether you're a decider, enabler, inventor, or creator?
We see now you're going to your finance.
Right?
Yeah, now we're going to your finance and VC model.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that
okay,
sort.
I was
yeah.
leading to that. But
I'm actually, no. When you want to sponsor that, we can go into that additional research.
All right.
Are you nearing being done, or you have more?
No, I have more material. I have some more material on this.
Because I want to put a bookmark to the fact that I like your sufficient fairness partly because it's what I tend to agree with, but I also think that actually your original statement of fairness is a bit of a red herring, because this is where you're headed. Once you build in the really what you're dealing with isn't an equality. Or even a veil of ignorance, other than procedurally, what you're really doing isn't reward in proportion to contribution. It's reward in proportion to the alternative.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's your real rule here is reward in proportion to the alternative.
I would argue that it should be expected fairness in reward in proportion to contribution for a very strong reason. All right, and this is independent of the effect on effort. If you add the effect on effort, as you observe, if you tax someone and you actually, you know, were to skew them all down via the apartheid mechanism, the effort, you could actually destroy the willingness to contribute
in the first place.
But independent of that, you probably have information asymmetry with respect to the other parties and their outside opportunities. You don't necessarily know what their true outside opportunities are. So in some sense, it's almost like the Vickery-Clark-Groves mechanism, where if you offer too much, you can be damned if you do, and if you offer too little, you're damned if you don't. So because there's information asymmetry over what their true outside opportunities are, you are probably best off as an individual offering the fair allocation.
Only in a true no negotiation.
Well, that's true.
Because any chance at negotiation will reveal and push one way or the other.
Well, be careful how much of that is cheap talk. If you can verify their outside opportunities, that's one thing. But there are going to be lots of claims that they may make which may be unverifiable. So you have to be careful about those.
Test those by getting up.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, you can. All right. This is 1 hour. There are a couple of additional ideas on. I actually want to tie this now to choice of property versus liability rules. Right. The problem is that property rules tend to be all or nothing. So there's one set of additional ideas, one last step, drawing it back to the law, about how I think there are occasions for actually using these ideas more broadly. Okay, when do property rights fail? This is actually a great question posed to me by Rob Merges. So, well, rights holders have the option to not exercise their rights. So why don't standard property rights work? And it's actually a very good, very profound question, because you know, if it's in their, if it's in the interests of the property rights holder to allow their right to their property to be used, well, why don't they just allow that to happen, right? So property rights still ought to work. There's a response, though, which is, in order for that to work correctly, you'd have to make a binding commitment to not exercise it in proportion to how much additional value was created, right? The problem is, as an all-or-nothing property right, they have to make a decision ex ante, and you're deciding ex post. And none of this stuff applies ex post to the individual. Ex post, you know whether you're the dictator, the prince, or the pauper, and you're very happy to propose the unfair allocation. So it has to be ex ante. The problem with these all-or-nothing property rights is the inspection problem and the monopsony problem. Because their good is essential, their property right in a particular good is essential, you're under-motivated to go explore on that and go create with that, because after the fact, they'll just take it. Or if you give them the idea, they can go run with it, right? So the difficulty there is that the all-or-nothing and ability to use it, and the injunctive relief, the ability to preclude them from using the idea if it's property, then prevents them from experimenting with it ex ante and trying to build on it ex ante.
Okay. It means that they won't experiment. It's not the property owner's problem. It's the would be builder
That's
upon
correct.
The property owner. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, because the property owner can be a property owner.
But it's actually it's in the second round, in the second layer, it's the property owner's problem. You'd like to be perceived as fair in order that folks would experiment on your good. But there's no guarantee that you will be, because you have the property right.
Right.
If they've suddenly found a cure for cancer using your tool, you say, heck with you, I'll just take the whole thing. You don't care about the foregone opportunity on the subsequent deals.
Although the subsequent deal may also have property right and under a patent system that means that they can't just expropriate. You've got to do a deal. So the property for the
yes.
second mover gives
yes.
you at least some.
If you have a second, if you have a second patent in that, so you could have the blocking patents,
yes.
which then would force some negotiation.
Right.
Which would force some negotiation.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
So I want to then just for those of you, you know, particularly on the computer science side, I want to give some just brief review of property rules versus liability rules. Property rules confer the power to enjoin all the other uses, and they also compensate you for not only the market value of a good, but even the private value of a good. So we could say, for example, you know, Mark might like Judy's car, and why should the state ever give him that car if he claims he needs it more than Judy does? Well, if he really doesn't need it, then he could actually buy it from her in a deal that would be better for both. This would include both the market value and any private subjective value, because she's free to decline any deal that doesn't cover both of those two things. So a property right confers both the subjective value and market value of that, so you can actually get a fair trade that way. It also provides the ability to enjoin alternate uses. But her use of one car doesn't preclude Mark's use of another car. So typically we use liability regimes to protect in that case, and that only protects replacement value. So you can't enjoin someone else from using their own version of the good. They can, if they use their good in a way that creates a negative externality for you, then they're liable for that negative externality. So if Mark bumps her car here, then he's liable for that, but at market value, not for any subjective value, just for market replacement value.
Which is not necessarily the way all liabilities rules would work. You could say a liability rule that plus subjective value, although subjective values are hard to prove.
Because that's very hard to prove.
But there are pieces of subjective value that you could design. You can even make some claims about.
Could design it that way.
Okay.
Could design it that way.
Okay.
It's not required, but could design it that way. Okay?
Yeah.
Then combining some of the ideas about externalities from COSE with some of the ideas on liability versus property rules, one of the ideas, you want to balance some transactions cost and assessment cost. These are kind of the negotiation versus adjudication in some ways. I really want to emphasize this for a stop here for a moment. If negotiation costs are low, use property rights. You don't care. Markets will get it right no matter what. COSE had a really deep insight in that. Because what happens is if negotiation costs are low, it doesn't matter. Whichever party values the good more will buy the right from the other one if they don't have it in the starting position, and therefore you get the efficient outcome. Okay? So negotiation costs are low, use property rights, and who gets the property right doesn't even matter. Markets will work efficiently. That's not true if negotiation costs are high. In that case, what you want to do is allow folks to proceed without negotiation, but subject to low liability. You assign liability to low-cost divider. So a PowerPoint wouldn't necessarily have to negotiate with every single citizen downstream, but if they then create pollution, then they're liable for the damage that they do. So there's a really nice summary of that provided, the protection. So focus on the first table for just a moment. Plaintiff versus defendant in a pollution case, this would be ways that they might be adjudicated. This is out of this was a summary of the Mellenbad and Calabresi and some of the Kosian stuff. Property rules versus liability rules, in an encyclopedia entry from Krauss. It shows, if you protect the property rule of the plaintiff with a property rule, they get a total injunction against pollution. If the property rule were assigned to the defendant, they would be allowed to pollute and no damages are awarded. That's the only protection that's afforded. On the other hand, if you protect the plaintiff with a liability rule, then pollution might be allowed, but any damages might then be awarded to the plaintiff. Or if you flip that, then you might get an injunction against pollution and damages awarded for D for not being able to produce the power. They've foregone their business because it's been enjoined by the other. So here's a way that you could use property versus liability rules. Then there's also a subsequent table, which is rather nice, in the assessment cost versus transactions cost. If the if they're low transactions costs but high assessment costs, if they're low transactions costs and high assessment costs, then you probably want to use the marketplace and property rights because folks will negotiate their way to the end. If they're very high transactions costs and low assessment costs, liability rules are preferable. Because in that case, the courts can actually decide fairly accurately. You allow folks to proceed, and any problem, you just adjudicate them. If both are really high, neither may be efficient. If both are really low, then either might be efficient. I want to draw this now, your attention now to information goods. These are arguments in favor of perhaps moving in the direction of liability rules for protecting information as opposed to property rights for information. And this is largely for copyright, not so much for patent. But I'll give you a couple of examples, a couple of cases when this might actually be more interesting. The marginal value of most remixes on places like YouTube, for example, is really, really small. If you think of the marginal value of any video some parent records their kid's piano recital and posts that on YouTube, the marginal value of each one of those things tends to be really small. But the negotiation costs for each of those one-way transactions are huge. If you actually had to negotiate the rights with Sony so that your kid could you could post their performance of some musical on YouTube, it would actually be quite costly to you relative to the value that would be created for any particular good. On the other hand, because the value across all possible uses probably does exceed the transactions cost and negotiation cost of any single negotiation. So you have to aggregate all of the opportunity losses of different ways this downstream good could be used. Another interesting point is legal arguments have traditionally focused exactly as on the encyclopedia entry, on the transactions costs or the adjudication costs. They have not tended to focus on the opportunity costs, the innovation that hasn't occurred. Why? Because people aren't showing up in courts for innovation that hasn't occurred. Right? You need to include some of those things as well in terms of the liability regime or the property regime. So these costs have not typically been folded into the calculus of what is the better regime for protection. Yes?
Marginal value of those remixes may come back to the copyright holder.
Yes.
I mean, that's the Grateful Dead kind of economic system that seems to be working in the internet.
Absolutely.
They actually allow people to tape and do a not outside of their jurisdiction
right.
marketplace of their tapes, which then built their fan base, which then allowed them to become one of the most successful touring acts. That
absolutely.
Gave them their income. So now, if your daughter is playing Maria on the
absolutely.
Piano and you put it on YouTube, somebody looks at it who's another parent in the PTA and says, oh yeah, West Side Story. I like West Side Story. I should buy that CD.
Mm-hmm.
Which
absolutely.
Is what happens from
yep.
time to time.
Yep.
So there is,
do
you figure that benefit of Remix anywhere in your equation?
A little bit. Let me look at this in two different ways. Now, the first point I'd like to make is this actually goes directly to Rob Merger's point. In some sense, they are protected under property rules. Grateful Dead is protected under property rules, and they chose not to exercise them because it was actually beneficial. So in that sense, the existing regime actually can account for that. So the existing, under the existing regime, it's possible for that to happen. The subtler point that I prefer to make, however, though, is what you really are asking is the question of economics of substitutes versus the economics of complements. And what they'd managed to do with low grain reproduction, you know, and you know, low quality tapes is that the those versions of the goods that were distributed were probably complementary to the sale of digitally mastered goods and other paraphernalia and merchandise, so that there was a good complementary economic benefit. The real thing you want to look at is the economics of complements versus substitutes. I'll come back to that a little bit when I look at the evolution of dance as an example of that. I don't know if you've seen that online. But in this case, the snippets are not substitutes. Another good example is Apple iTunes Store. You get 20 seconds of a song, it's not the song. You can decide whether you like the song based on the 20 seconds, but you're not going to actually give up the song for only listening to repetitions of that same 20 seconds. So it's a complement rather than a substitute. So the, really what you want to look at is that that set of principles. Yes?
Just a quick question in regard to your point two there. So why you say that's largely for copyright? Because, for example, if you are trying to standardize patent licensing and saying that actually you're going to pay me just a percentage of the success, you are trying to, through the standard license, to lower transaction costs, so liability, but you are at the same time counting on how much the innovation is going to be used for or not, because you are putting a percentage, like, right. So I don't know, like, Mike, was just a curiosity why you put just for larger before.
It's mostly, I would argue, it's more for copyright for the following reason. If you have a patent, you have the ability to enjoin its use in any form for that specific good. For copyright, you only have the ability to enjoin the specific expression and not the underlying idea. You can't have a copyright in the idea, right? So that's why. And that's, it's because it's not, it doesn't rise to the level of property in many instances. It, well, the idea itself isn't necessarily protected, but the expression is protected, where that's not so true in patent. The idea, if you take it in one, to, you know, if you take it in one medium and then move it to another medium, you've still got the, you've still got the protection. Okay? So I want to say innovation under a property rule feeds into downstream innovation, exhibits more of the monopoly and inspection paradox problems in tangible goods. So it doesn't work as much for those. And this last one is really a lot of fun. It's a really simple statistical fact. If you take the uses of a particular child's recital on which instrument they're playing and which song they're playing, the best way to do it is have lots of variation in your statistical models across the different inputs. This is exactly what you need in order to determine the marginal value of each contribution. So if you allow for a liability rule where folks could actually proceed to experiment and then see what the population values via what gets downloaded, what gets viewed, what advertisers are willing to advertise on, you can work out the statistical models to figure out what those marginal contributions would be. So this is a way of actually then doing the allocation once the remixes have in fact been made. Okay? The last idea I want to give you is to take Coase and Melamed and invert it. What was the original claim? This was, if negotiation costs are high, assign liability to the low-cost avoider. This isn't for the negative externality. That's for the pollution firm. So they can proceed, but with the low-cost avoider, they're liable for the damages. Flip the insight. If negotiation costs are high, assign liability to the low-cost producer. They're free to proceed, but if they create something of enormous value, they need to give some value back to the original source. If they do damage, they need to take care of the original source. So it's the same insight inverted, right? So it's another way of trying to use that set of ideas.
Do you see that applying with the whole privacy and how to treat privacy?
Boy, there's a whole other set of issues to try to, there may be ways to actually think directly applying that to privacy, but whether or not you do it. And then if you, then you respond, you absolutely ought to be responsible for damage.
A certain kind of information is a huge variance.
It's huge variation.
And you say that property is even control or ownership, but it's not even clear that you don't own
absolutely.
It. You know, but once you have these prohibitions on data protection or privacy protection that become, that actually prevent a lot of things from happening and create the opportunity cost.
That's correct. Right, so you might be able to do much more with something
I
like
would think so.
With a regime like this. Yeah, Oliver.
Yeah, I, would presume you're aware of the compulsory license structures under the Copyright Act.
Yes.
Because that would appear to be at least a version of what you're talking about.
Yes, okay. That would be that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would be that kind of thing.
Are you talking about privacy in relationship to digital rights management, that kind of stuff?
I'm talking about it in sort of personal identifying information. Okay. And it's and strictures on certain types of information. And then controlling and having absolute control over that versus it's hard to know what the damages would be unless their damages are, and then to create the right incentive mechanisms to do that. Because certain things, who cares? And other things, it makes a big difference. But right now, it doesn't work.
Yes. One last set of ideas. There are instances where folks have actually used fairness for this. One of the nicer examples was someone accidentally infringed a song in a 9-song review, and rather than simply enjoining the whole review, they gave them a ninth of the revenues from this. So that was there are instances in which kind of fairness principles have actually been applied. But also in some cases of these multi-part goods. This last slide, I actually owe several of the examples to Von Tan, first two in particular. Robert Amesbury has this wonderful set of collages. He takes images from other places and then creates this amazing images composed of the images of others. Some of them are just absolutely beautiful. If I were actually connected to the internet, I could actually put, these are all hyperlinks, since this is their other stuff, I can actually link directly through to their stuff, and so you can actually see this. This is Girl Talk, is another example. He takes these snippets of songs and recomposes them to make his own songs. And there's such small pieces of it, they're shorter than it's variation, it's remixing. And so he's actually running a rock concert here off of his laptop, creating music from music that's already been created. This one over here, Evolution of Dance, is wonderful. This was, I don't know if it's still the case, but this was the number one most viewed video on YouTube for over 3 years. It's more than 24 different songs where he puts the evolution of dance is he puts the music of a particular group and then does a particular dance move like that. And what's interesting is that each snippet is less than the 20 seconds of free song that Apple gives on its iTunes. So clearly he would be infringing copyright because he's taking the music and then showing it and then actually doing something with it. But he's adding immense value. This was he was very creative, adding his own dance maneuvers to these hit songs and each of the different periods from the 70s, 80s, and 90s to actually make this evolution of dance. The last one is actually here. This is my homepage on iGoogle, and you can actually see different things here. And the first couple are Wall Street Journal, New York Times link, Slashdot, which is also a composition of other stories. I even get some Al Jazeera in here, so I can get some variety of news. And Dow Jones News. This is a compendium of sources. If you were to use a fairness algorithm, rather than enjoining the aggregators, what you do is you then apportion them a fraction of the revenues in proportion to the value that they're also creating. And you can track what folks click through, what they're watching, and doing that. But this would allow the facilitation of multi-part composite information goods as opposed to enjoining that activity, as opposed to not allowing others to proceed. So this would be a way of actually trying to adjudicate some of those things. Other applications, we've got unanticipated windfalls, indispensable compliments, scientific credit. This is another remix. Radiohead is a wonderful example of a band. They put their tracks out on the internet, allow others to remix those tracks and resubmit them. And these are wonderful. They're incredibly different. The community has created marvelous reinterpretations of their tracks. They do one thing I disagree with, though, which is all or nothing. Everything that you submit, they claim they own 100%. Again, I think it's not quite their community has added value. They should be giving some other value back to the individual participants. I do a lot of work on platform ecosystems. How would you manage the ecosystem on the Apple iPhone? How would you manage the ecosystem on Salesforce.com? How would you manage the ecosystem on Windows? Using a lot of these mechanisms, we think we can show if you implement these kinds of contracts, you ought to increase the rates of innovation on these various platforms. Or employment contracting is one of the examples I gave you at the very beginning. These all or nothing property rights held by the employer tend to discourage folks from innovating inside their organizations. Google has been pretty good, for example, about giving its employees interest in spin-offs or interested in new enterprises, generating ideas. So those kinds of reward in proportion to contribution, I argue, are big stimuli to innovation as a whole. You really, really need to ask the question of fairness not as an allocation question. You need to ask, what is it about fairness that leads to innovation? And that actually, I think, is where a lot of the power comes. Yes. Yes.
Or one particular one. There are other examples, of course. I just wondered how you'd apply these principles in that case, because...
I would have... You might have given Gold, the doctor, some principal rights, but then also allocated a fraction of the benefit to Moore, whose spleen it was that provided those unique genetic properties. Again, you have interesting problems if you go either direction. If you go all the property rights to Gold or all the property rights to Moore, you may still not get the experimentation.
But even so, I mean, the doctor has a lot more options, a lot more spleens that he can sample than...
That's correct.
The individual has of doctors who might want to use their cells and might have that.
So a fair mechanism should account for that. The degree to which your particular Reese has highly substitutable would depress the proportional value that you've contributed. The Shapley value does a particularly good job of actually looking at other possible uses of your particular contribution and then accounting for that. So that's one mechanism that you could use to do that.
I believe there is some case law on this. There's at least one person that I know who sued. And it's also very famous, the Helen Lane. The Hela cells, which are widely used for testing drugs and other things. And she never got any compensation for that at all. But there is some case law around biological DNA issues. Who owns your DNA? Well, you don't necessarily own your DNA. It reproduces you probably which.
Yes.
You know, so
yeah.
I would look at the case law and the history and see how that works out in terms of your theories.
That would be great. Thank you. Another question?
You argue that market forces are almost perfect and they'll bring the, which I tend to agree. But you also, on another hand, you're saying that if it's not beneficial and cannot, then it should not be able to withstand the market forces for decades, if not centuries. Employers has managed to get employees to sign contracts mm-hmm. where all the inventions belongs to employer. To me, it's a contradiction.
Okay, it's two different things. One, I don't say markets always get it right. One of the big issues is information creates externalities. When there are externalities, markets often break down. One of the first slides is why information causes market failures. So market failures happen all the time when there are externalities, and information goods are big reasons for that. More specifically, often it's the case that the employees may not have outside options. And that's exactly like the assortative question. If there aren't fewer opportunities, then you can extract extract up to the outside option from a person. And that's not fair, but it's entirely feasible for people to extract from any individual down to their next outside option. And that happens all the time. So you can see why that would happen in employment contracts. Okay, the principal message I wanted to give: fairness is not just an ethical choice, it's also an economically rational choice. But you have to look at the incentive for innovation behind the veil of ignorance of what might happen downstream versus just the allocation question. If you only look at allocation, then we're back to George Moore. You can't prove anything with it. You have to take it as axiomatic. If, on the other hand, you look downstream at the creation of wealth, we can say whatever your definition of wealth, it will be a Pareto improvement, and fairness helps lead to that. Ergo, we can call it an economically rational choice, even at the individual single instance level, ex ante. Be very clear, it's ex ante, not necessarily ex post. Ex post, you've got extra power and you might be willing to cheat on the deal. Okay? So fairness is not just an ethical choice, it is also an economically rational choice. So the basic issues here are we get to resolve the inspection paradox. Property rights have these costs of delays, hold up, monopsony. Any ex ante allocations decided before the innovation can wind up being unfair ex post. The trick is it'll go for an allocation process. You really need to go to something with the expectation of fair reward as upon the conclusion. So commit to a fair process, not to an allocation up front. The benefits are it allows parties to disagree agree to disagree and move forward under contract, or they can realize what the innovation is and what the relative contributions were. It doesn't resort to any ad hoc other regarding preferences. Pure, rational self-interest alone is sufficient to justify fairness. We think that's a fairly novel, fairly important result. We increase the rate of information sharing and thus the social rate of innovation. We also increase the rate of innovation in a second dimension, not because information is shared, but because of the choice of projects. People will choose the social optimum as opposed to the private optimum, and under fairness, those two things align. It promotes experimentation in cases when property rights otherwise create holdup, so you can create the downstream remixes and possible reuse of information in unanticipated ways not thought through by the original inventor. So a lot of the things we've been taking as axiomatic can actually be reduced to rational interest and wealth creation. Thank you.
Thank you.